Good afternoon. Welcome along. This is Good in a Crisis number 4. And with me today, I have Carol Gatewood, who's the manager of Dialhouse at Touchstone. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Barry. How are you? How are you doing?
I'm all right. Bit tired, bit exhausted after my day. But yeah, generally feeling quite good, I think.
Yeah.
What about you?
The feeling's mutual. Yeah. Quite tired. My son was not well last night. So yeah, I'm just recovering and getting back into work mode, but yeah, I'm good, thanks.
All right, well, so a little bit tired for starting off a shift because you're doing a shift in a minute.
Yeah.
You need some coffees to get you through that.
Okay. Yeah.
So I want to hear about you basically today. I want to hear about your life and your history working at Leeds Survivor and Crisis Service, things you've been through, and why we have a BAME specific crisis house. Why there's a need for it, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So,
all right.
So this is what we're going to be talking about today.
Okay, great stuff.
So do you want to start off with what brought you to this work in the first place?
So basically, my early days of work started in early years. I used to work in early years nursery, and then sort of like I progressed into outreach work. So I was a development worker for a BAME service, and we would support Black ethnic minorities to do their policies, procedures, those kind of things for new and upcoming groups. And so my love for that, I just grew out of that, wanting to do outreach and be out in the community. So I started to get into family support work. I worked within the children's centres, worked within those with Shawstart, did those kind of things. So did outreach into the community with Shawstart, did family support work with Shawstart. But as I started to do more family work, I started to go into families' homes. I noticed there was a lot of parents at home in crisis.
Right.
So I started to do a lot more of what was more crisis work than supporting parents at home with, you know, young toddlers, getting the children to school, supporting parents with daily tasks. I realised there was a lot more underneath that I had to do before parents could get to the point of getting the children to school and time and, you know, setting boundaries and stuff for children. So there tend to be a lot of crisis work. So then I thought, why don't I try and sort of like get into that area of work? Because I was doing a lot of it. And I saw the advert for Leeds Survivor-Led Crisis Service wanting volunteers. So that was 2005, I believe. So I became a volunteer within Dialhouse.
So you went straight in as a Dialhouse volunteer?
I went straight into Dialhouse because Dialhouse were looking for volunteers rather than Connect. So I did it the opposite way around. So I went into Dialhouse and then got onto the Connect helpline. I think I did nearly a year maybe, and a temporary job came up, got the temporary job, did that again, I think probably for about 6-7 months. And then a job came up again. But that was a permanent job then, and I applied and I got that. But back then we just did weekends. So I would work Monday to Friday doing my archway job, which was working with young people and working with organisations that supported children under 13 years of age. So I was doing that as well as doing my Shawstart job and then working on a weekend at Dialhouse.
Yeah, because I remember when I met you, I couldn't believe that you worked like during the week and then in the evening at weekends too.
Yeah. When I look back now, I think, what was I doing? But I think at that point, it was sort of like my height of my career and I was a bit unsure which way I wanted to fit in. So I had my foot in quite a few bits of work and volunteering. So then I'd got that post, and then we got, I think the Monday night, we got further funding for a Monday night. So in turn, I dropped a couple of hours at my other job to do a Monday night. It was temporary the Monday night, but then it became permanent with the rest of the shifts. And then we got a Wednesday night. So then I became Monday, Wednesday, and I think two nights over the weekend. So dropped a couple of hours again. Eventually, I became a Dalhouse person. I was embedded in the Dalhouse philosophy and the love of Dalhouse, and you know, just everything it stood for. And it just felt like this is where I really wanted to be. So in the midst of all that, being in the service, I know I kept saying we need to get more BAME visitors to attend Dalhouse. I kept saying it to Fiona Venner, our chief exec. I kept saying we need to get more BAME people in the service. We need to. And she's saying, yeah. We kept saying, what could we do? What could we do? And so many ideas we had over the years to try and get BAME people into the service, and it just never worked. So then I said to Fiona, what about if we had just a different project just for BAME people and see how it works? And then eventually, I can't remember how many years after, it was a good while after, because I think we started in 2013, the BAME project, and it just came out of big lottery money. And so in the beginning, what we were looking to fund was a service just for black males, because, you know, as you know, black males are overrepresented in hospitals, police cells,
psychiatric hospitals.
Yeah. So we looked into that, and we thought, yeah, it would be. But then there was just somehow I just felt, ew. And then we thought about it, and we thought, let's just open it up to BAME people, but with a massive emphasis on black males. Right. So that was always, you know, one of the big things we were trying to reach. And so the service got set up 2013, we got funding, but Daniel Dimitri came over and he was the manager, and I applied for the senior and got it. So then became the senior of Dalhouse at Touchstone 2013, and we're still there. So I think Daniel left, I can't remember now, it might have been around, I'm never good with dates, I'd say probably about 2015, 16 maybe.
Something like that, yeah.
Somewhere around there. For probably about 9 months. I covered for probably about nine months as the manager.
And you didn't want to be the manager?
I was just going to say, I didn't want to be the manager, but I stepped in because we didn't have anybody. And I stepped in and I did a really good job. The service turned around. We got lots of visitors. It just changed completely. I spoke to a lot of the visitors regularly and asked them what they wanted, what they would like. We have a lot of refugee and asylum seekers. And a lot of them miss back home, miss their parents, family members, brothers, sisters, siblings. So what came out of some of my discussions with some of the visitors was they would like to have a social evening and just to be around people and make it feel quite like their family, because a lot of them come from big families and, you know, miss, you know, just generally seeing and being around family. And obviously are still isolated and lonely here in England, in this country. A lot of our visitors are isolated. That's one of our biggest outcomes in terms of monitoring. A lot of our visitors are lonely and isolated. So in turn, we came up with a social evening, and that just went from strength to strength. People just kept coming, hearing about the service. You know, a lot of people, especially from BAME backgrounds in different countries, wouldn't have anything like this. There's not such a thing as counselling then. Back home in their country, they would go to aunties and uncles and, you know, family members. So to have a crisis service, especially for BAME people, where they can talk about their issues, where people from their own minority get what their crisis is, was just amazing for people. And then the job came up for the manager's post, and yet again I was like, no, I'm all right, I'll go back to my senior post. So we've got an interim manager, and she came in. She was really good as well, we got on really well, but then she had some family issues and had to leave. And then it came up again, and then Alison and Fiona's like, come on, you're doing such a good job, come on. I'm like, oh, I don't know. I was just so nervous because I just didn't want to fail. I wanted to be the best that I could at this job, at this role. And I just felt, as senior, I can do that. You know, no one's watching me. I can just do what I do as senior and just be okay. But anyway, it wasn't good enough. So I did eventually apply and got the role. And I'm glad I did, to be honest.
Because, what changed your mind then to do it in the end?
Well, I think it was Alison, because Alison said to me, come on, Carol, this job's a challenge. It's a challenge. You've been in this role for so many years. And she was saying, you know, why wouldn't you want a challenge? You know, it just makes work much more fun, and much more to deal with. You know, she was selling it to me and she was saying, if every day was the same, you'd be bored.
Absolutely.
This way you get different things. And I was like, And I was like, right, okay, all right. Let me step out of my comfort zone, because it was really out of my comfort zone. And you know, I did a lot of research. I started to speak to a lot of people out and about in the community. I spoke to other Black managers from in Touchstone and how it feels to run a BAME organisation. Because that's another thing, you know. You've obviously got the things that are a daily crisis with regards to people in a crisis, but obviously I've got the added pressures of people coming from a BAME background. You know, you've got your racism, your prejudice, your oppression. So there's all those things, as well as people being in a crisis. You know, obviously I've got all a BAME team, because we're all a BAME team that work at Dalhousie at Touchstone. And that again is another dynamic. You know, we're all from BAME backgrounds, but we've all got our own different cultures. We've got our own different religions. So I think it was just for me, it was the fact of having all that on, as well as having to deal with people in crisis. But now, looking back, I wouldn't turn it away for the world. It's just, it's been a massive learning curve for me. Mm-hmm. I don't know everything. Some of the cultures, some of the religions. I'm learning all the time in this role, which I'm loving. You know, the service has gone from strength to strength, and I just think it's what's definitely needed out there for our BAME communities, because when you're in crisis, there's many things that come into play when you're in crisis, but obviously you still want to live the life you're accustomed to. So if you're very religious, you'll still attend church, you still want to go to the mosque, you still want to do all those kind of things whilst being in crisis, but it's an added pressure, you know, because when you come from a BAME background, you've got a lot of extended family that are involved in your care. So we have to be mindful that people are still getting their needs met, you know, with regards to their religion, their culture, all those kind of things still come into play. So, you know, within Dalhousie at Touchstone, we've got a prayer room, you know, we have different kinds of things that people may want to do differently, such as some people find that being locked in a room is not what they want to do. It's not helpful for people when they're in crisis, because sitting in a room and speaking about it feels very westernized to some of our visitors. So we have the option of being out in the garden, going for a walk, going to the park. You know, we can do that in Dalhousie, but that for somebody else that has been, say, tortured in his own country back home or her country, it brings back a lot of memories. So we work differently within Dalhousie at Touchstone with a lot of our visitors. That's just only come from us learning that, you know, people will tell us it's not helpful to do this, it's not helpful to do that, you know, and that was one of the things that we learned, you know, when in Dalhousie you do the referral process, it's very triggering for a lot of our visitors, the referral questions, you know, over and over, what would you do, what would you not? So we've learned not to do that. So we take it on what they want to tell us. We trust what they want to tell us rather than giving them the 20 questions. That is quite triggering to some people. We've learned things over the years.
What do you do then when you're busy and you haven't got enough space? If you don't ask people the questions, how do you decide who's prioritised that night for a visit?
Well, how we've gone about prioritising people, we never really used to have frequent visitors. When we first probably say like in the first 3 to 4 years, we would see somebody this week and maybe not see them again for another month. So in turn, it would make it a lot easier to decide as we've got up to capacity. But within the last 3 years, I would say, we've had to start turning people away. But now, because we've been going a lot longer, we've got people that are coming more regular. So it is a bit more like the process of Dalhouse. So we would look at who was in last week, who we know maybe is struggling, who we don't know. So if we've had people that we've never seen before, they'll get priority. If we have people we haven't seen for a long time, they'll get priority and so forth.
So it's really about the relationships that you've built with them. You're able to sort of, you got a feel for what's going on for these people.
Yeah. But we also have direct access still at Dalhouse.
Turn up at the door.
And where people can turn up at the door. So on any night, we could have maybe 10 people come through. But the thing is, with Dalhouse at Touchstone, people get what they need and leave. So we may have 10 people in the night, but not all at the same time.
I see.
So we'll have somebody come for the first 2 hours and they'll leave. And we've grown to know who will leave. So we have quite a few visitors that will come, do 2 hours and go. So we'll think, right, okay, that person will only be here for maximum 2 hours. That person could come later in the evening when they've gone and, you know, vice versa. And then the direct access, we have a lot of our visitors that don't have a mobile phone, that have no fixed abode. So in turn, turning up at the door works for them. So we have a few visitors that we know will definitely just turn up without ringing. And that's due to them being homeless, not having a mobile phone, just many different reasons that a lot of people don't. We have at least 5 people I can think of my head that do not like to speak on the phone, would not speak on the phone. So the referral process, whether it's not asking or asking, is not good for them. So their direct access again. But yeah, so like I said, we could have maybe up to 10, 11 people come through the house in that night at different times when we're open.
Okay. And when you mentioned about having supports like outside or going for a walk, I mean, that sort of thing happens in Dalhouse about once every 3 months or something. Is it much more than that at Dalhouse at Touchstone?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Maybe on most nights we're open, somebody will definitely probably be outside for support.
And does a lot of that come from like histories of like being confined and things like that?
Yeah. Yes, being confined, being tortured, being abused, just don't find it helpful. And because our way of sitting in a room and having support is not the norm for some people, they've never had that in their own country. They don't know what it looks like or feels like. So it feels quite strange to do that in a supportive way, whereas they wouldn't have it in a supportive way. They'd have it in another way that wouldn't be very nice to them. So it's hard for them to get that in their head that somebody's being really nice and kind to them in this room that would normally be a room of something else for them, if you see what I mean.
Sure, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. Right, wow, that's really interesting.
Yep. So we're still here.
If you feel able to, can you tell me a bit about you and your life experiences and how that feeds into your understanding of why it's so important to have a BAME-specific service? And so I asked this question based on, as a white person, and I've heard other white people saying, well, surely we just need to, I mean, I've said this before, we just need to make Dalhouse a bit more accessible to BAME people. What can we change? Can we have, like, different wallpaper or something like that? You know?
Yeah. I think, for our visitors, and I'll speak for myself, culturally, there's a different aspect when you're in crisis, when you sit down with somebody that understands your family dynamics, that understands the religion, that understands the faith. You know, in certain communities, when it comes to your parents, it's a massive respect. You have to, elders, you know, respecting elders is a massive thing. And it's about coming to a service that somebody is going to know and get. When I speak about, I can't go against my parents, and my parents that are doing whatever they're doing to me, that's not right, but they're my elders and I've got to respect my elders. We get that, you know. Some people won't be able to understand the dynamics of being in a family where it comes down to, you've got to respect your elders. So, and, you know, you may think, well, even though they're your elders, you don't have to stay and take it. But, you know, that kind of mentality, you can't, you'll be brought up that way. So you just have to go along with some of the things that you know are not right, some of the things you know that are not helping, but it's hard to get out of that way of thinking because you're being brought up to respect your elders. So there's things like that that we have, where we understand people's religion, we will work with people's religion, we talk about religion all the time. It is on the topic at Dar House at Touchstone every time we're open. Most of our visitors have got some kind of faith. So it's about understanding and having an understanding of that and accepting that and accepting some of the things in some people's cultures that may be different to the white British culture. And so speaking to a white British person that will have no kind of understanding of how some of the cultures are, it's hard to speak to somebody that doesn't have that kind of understanding. Yes, to understand all the things that we talk about, but those added little things just make that a little bit different. We come from big families, majority of BIM communities, so we have to tend to shout. We're quite loud people. And so, you know, if you were to come to Dar House at Touchstone on any given night, it's loud, you know. As well as the staff, as well as the visitors. And it's just that accepting of people's culture, accepting of people being loud, accepting of people being jolly. I know what feedback, one of the feedback that I've had a lot of times from a lot of our visitors is how they don't feel like they have to be stuck in their own stuff. So when they come through the door, people are friendly and people are lively, which makes them forget about the crisis. And a lot of our visitors said that helps, you know, that just to be in an environment that's a bit more uplifting and a bit more happy just feels good for those 5-6 hours in order for them to go back to obviously what's going on at home, just uplifts them while they're there. So yeah, I think it's just being able to be themselves. And I think sometimes when you are from a BAME community, to be surrounded by British white people and be yourself can be very hard. And I think because people are not accepting of certain cultures, you know, it feels, what I say is, people can talk in their home language in our communal areas. People do that all the time. It's done without battering an eyelid, you know, but I know people have said when they're in a different setting, they feel like they can't be themselves, so they wouldn't speak rather than speak in their mother tongue, you know. So it's those little things that make it a little bit different for some of our visitors, that they feel like they can be themselves when they come to Dar House at Touchstone, where they don't have to sit in silence then. You know, for a lot of our visitors, rather than speaking up, they'll sit in silence. Rather than saying what they really want, they're not going to address things. They're going to feel that people are judging them for the way they speak, the language they speak, you know. And so in turn, they will stay silent.
Yeah.
And so that is one of the difference that Dar House at Touchstone has to Dar House, that people feel they can be themselves and not be judged of how they speak, their language they speak, you know, what they look like, you know. And sometimes we have people's own music on in the background, so people's music will play from different countries, you know. So little things like that are the things that we do to make people feel at home. You know, we have a lot of our visitors that find cooking very therapeutic. So food in a BAME community is a massive thing. You know, wherever you come from, food is the center, and the, you know, so a lot of our visitors will come and cook, you know, and it's their way as well to show appreciation for the support they've had. I know we have, I think, about 3-4 visitors, and every time they come, they'll say, can I cook? And I'll say, yes, just let me know what you need. And you should see the light face up when people are sat around the table eating their food. It's like a joy of, you know, feeding your family on a Sunday. it just, you know, it just brings us such a different dynamic.
And you look really happy describing this as well. So it must be infectious. Though.
I think because the amount of people we've had come through our door that have cooked for us, and the different ranges of food from different places has been amazing.
You're making me hungry now.
I know, I'm making myself hungry. But, you know, when I think about that, I just think we've had some people come through our doors, honestly, that has just blown our minds away when it comes to sitting down for cuisine, food, you know. Mm. People pay a lot of money for this, and we've got that at Dial House at Touchstone on a Thursday of a social night. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, we have that. That's it. That's one of our, I think one of our good things that we're good at is getting people to come in and talk. And, you know, obviously once you're eating around the table, people are talking about all kinds of things. You know, you're learning about people's cultures, you know, you're learning about where people are from and, you know, the mother tongue. And there's just so many different things that people get educated about just being sat around the dining table. Mm. You know, on our social nights, we try and incorporate games that will help our visitors. So we do, like, we've done like language bingo, you know, for instance. That's one of the things we've done. So we will ask all of our visitors the language they speak, and we've looked up phrases from their country and put that in the bingo, and some of the visitors are just blown away. That's my language, that's my language, you know. They'll see that and put it down, and just to know that we've involved them in this game of language bingo has been amazing. We've done different, we try to tend to do different things around different people's countries. So we may do, we've had an Irish night where we've had Irish people coming in playing the song Irish Jig. We've been outside, we've had poetry night. We've had an African night where we've had people come and read tales. And, you know, so we try and just involve everybody that comes within the service and get their say and what they would like. And, you know, it's very peer-led. We try and involve them in all aspects of it, what they would like to see, what they would like to hear, you know. So it's just different things. And it's touched a lot of people that we've seen come through the service. Mm.
I mean, on the surface, it sounds quite simple what you're providing, but I guess that the key is that for people to be able to express themselves so naturally and easily, they've got to feel safe. So it must be feel like a really safe environment for anyone that comes there.
Definitely, definitely. And people have told us that, you know, there's a young man that we've seen back and forth. He's a refugee, and they've moved him from every corner of Leeds and then out of Leeds and then back into Leeds. You know, he's been and every single time he comes back to Leeds, he finds us, you know. And for him, he says we are his lifeline. He would have never been here today without us, because on a night when he's struggling, there is no other service he feels comfortable at being in, you know. And this man has carried for years his home on his back, in his rucksack. Every place he goes to, he carries it, he takes it with him, and he brings it out with him. And he's been doing that from, I think, from since we've opened, to be honest. He's still not, you know, got his status, but we're still in touch with him, as are some of the other visitors we see. But there's a good handful that we can think of that we have really made a difference. You know, we have a lot of people that come to us with very little English, and keep coming back. You know, we've had a young man who's English, kept saying he wanted to go back and do English, wanted to go back and learn English. He went back and he learned English at the Solar ESOL classes, learned English. He's now in college. He's now in college doing his social health and social care. And, you know, there's many stories. We had a young lady wanted to go back to work, and she said she could never ever face going back to work. She came to us for probably about 2 years, every night we were open, and she's back in employment full time now. She's loving it. She looks so different. We don't see her. She only comes now and again with social night, just just to show us she's still doing well. You know, she just taps in when she needs us and taps back out. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've had many success stories as well over the years. We've had a young man, again, who had very little English, would come and we'd all speak into his phone and translate, you know, and we did that for many months. He also went to English classes, learnt English, went back and did his driving licence and got his driving licence. So we've had many people come through our doors that have achieved something, and that's from having that support from us that they would never have got any, like a taste
of home as well, is the impression. Yes. I get when you describe the guy who kept getting moved around.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
like yeah. I can imagine feeling really isolated, being in a strange country and having nobody, but yeah, then knowing that there's this service, and when I go there, yes, it's almost like a family that welcomes me.
Yeah, and that's exactly what he says. Exactly what he says. So yeah, I'm very proud of the work that me and my team have done over the years, because we've touched many people. You know, the thing with Dire House at Touchstone, there's a lot of people that have come through our doors a couple of times and we've not seen them ever again, you know, as with Dire House. But, you know, we always wonder, I wonder what's happened to such and such. I wonder if they're still in the country, you know, because obviously people get deported sometimes. So, you know, we always have that. And then they'll ring us and say, oh, I'm in London now and I'm working. And, you know, so they always like to feed back in to let us know. We've had some we don't hear about. But, you know, I think people just feel like this is a service that they feel they can trust, as well as there's people from their own community that they feel they can feel some kind of connection with. You know, that just makes that crisis a little bit better. And I think as well what helps a lot of our visitors is we say we're a survivor-led and they'll say, what? And we'll say a survivor-led, it means we've all had our own traumas within our lifetime as well. So when we explain that to them, they just feel, wow, you know, this is a service that people have actually know what I'm going through, you know, not just on the tip of some of the stuff, you know, deep down prejudice, the racism, as well as trying to get support when you're in crisis, they have been through that as well. So for and some people,
you've told me a story as well before about a visitor was talking to you and then somehow it came into conversation about you being the manager, and they were like, what, you're the manager? Like, for you as a black woman being the role model of I'm the manager of service, that must be great for people as well.
Yeah, definitely. You know, this young man, it was funny really, but it was good to see his face, because he said, I expected to see a man in a white shirt and tie. I can't believe you're the manager. I said, I assure you I'm the manager, love. But it, you know, just knowing that people have that perception of a manager to be a man, whether it's a black man or a white man, you know, being in that position as a black female just is really empowering for me, you know, to think that, okay, these people are expecting to see something else and see me, you know, it's empowering, but I find it heartwarming as well that they're gonna have to look up to me as being the manager as a black woman, whereas I know from certain communities, the women are not allowed to work, not allowed to be in any kind of role. Yeah. So for me, it's quite empowering for me, but also for them to see that women can do these jobs, you know, so yeah, so that was, yeah. But yeah, I get that quite a bit, that they say, well, I'm the manager. You're the manager. Yep, I'm the manager. So I do try and just mosey on around in the service and not throw my weight around type of thing, and not let people know. But then they say, can we speak to the manager? You're speaking to her, you know, and it's like, oh, and it's like that. But so, you know, I try and play it down as much as I can, but when I need to, I'm there. But
Great. Well, Carol, thank you very much. I better let you go because the shift's about to start.
Oh, is it that long? Thank you anyway.
Thank you. It's been fascinating. I feel like I've got a real taste of what the service is like now. I've been, for a long time, I've been trying to understand, but listening to you talk today has made a lot of sense to me. So just so people know, you're open on Tuesday and Thursday nights.
Yeah, Tuesday and Thursday night, still with, obviously with the COVID-19, we're still open, doing phone support, only at the moment still. But yeah, so we're here. We're still running groups as well. So the women's group, the BAME women's group, is still run on a Monday by Shayem, and Patrick's still running his men's group.
Are these
over Zoom?
Over Zoom. And the men's group's on a Thursday, is it?
Thursday, I think it's 3 till 5, right. And then the women's group is 11 till 2
on a Monday.
On a Monday with Shayem, and yes, those are still running.
Great. And, yeah. And what's your phone number for people to get in touch with you?
Oh, now you're asking, aren't you? I will give you my phone number.
Not your personal one.
Not my own personal number. So it's 0113
yeah.
249-4675. So that's Dial House at Touchstone. 0113 249-4675.
From 6 o'clock on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
Great stuff.
Carol Greatwood, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Have a lovely
Thanks
shift.
Thanks a lot. Bye, Barry. Thank Bye you. Bye.
Cheers.